Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokesman.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that appreciates nothing more than a good murder mystery. That appreciation certainly applies to the films of Alfred Hitchcock, but it also extends, at least once apiece, to such filmmakers as Anthony Minghella and Wim Wenders. It's fitting that all three have adapted novels by Patricia Highsmith, the novelist described in the New York Times as, quote, a woman at the mercy of her emotional tides drawn to the darkest corners of her psyche, unquote. Highsmith played out her obsession with characters who, for the most part, are psychological oddities in some 22 novels and numerous short stories. And the most famous of them all, Tom Ripley, is featured in 5 individual novels, a.k.a. The Ripleyad. Duplicitous, morally indifferent, and capable of murder to get what he wants, Ripley skulks his way through the 8-episode miniseries that Steven Zaillian wrote and directed for Netflix, titled succinctly enough, Ripley. The three of us will discuss the series, and then in the second half of the show, we'll share some of our favorite Highsmith-adapted films. Let's start, though, by heading to Italy's Amalfi Coast. That's where our protagonist, Tom Ripley, played by Andrew Scott, is hired to go. The man who hires him is Herbert Greenleaf, played by the filmmaker Kenneth Lonergan, who's concerned that his son, Dickie, played by Johnny Flynn, who he thinks is wasting his time living in Italy, the year is 1960. What the elder Greenleaf doesn't know is that Ripley is a con artist who jumps at the chance to get paid to go on his own vacation. Once in Italy, specifically in the seaside town of Atrani, he inserts himself into Dickie's world, which includes his girlfriend Marge, played by Dakota Fanning. And like all predators, he begins to take over, resorting to violence when his plans stall. Not just once, but as author Highsmith makes clear in her 5 Ripley books, multiple times. Writer-director Zaillian, who won an Oscar for writing the screenplay for Steven Spielberg's 1993 film Schindler's List, has his own take on Highsmith's Ripley, just as other filmmakers, from Anthony Minghella to Wim Wenders to René Clément, have interpreted the character differently. He and the talented Scott make this Ripley more creepy than most, which is every bit an artistic choice, as was Zaillian's decision to shoot everything in atmospheric black and white, courtesy of the skilled cinematographer Robert Elswit. And to some of us, at least, it's the most effective portrayal of all.
Okay, Dan, you have to own this. The reason why you liked Ripley the series is because of Caravaggio.
And well, yes.
I wanted to talk about Caravaggio, too. So
okay, yeah, so we'll save that for later. Okay, but that's just an important aspect of this that I knew would get Dan's
attention.
Black
and white, too, so come on.
Oh, okay. And I think if we're going to look at this as a standalone, outside the work of Patricia Highsmith, outside of the other portrayals or adaptations, which we'll talk about in the second half of the show, I think that there was an aspect of this that was so compelling that it just made me cringe, because the portrayal by Andrew Scott of Ripley is probably most true to the book of all of the things that have been out there. But it's not the way that I wanted to think about Tom Ripley. And so maybe that's on me. But one of the problems that I had immediately was the fact that the film shifts the time frame a little bit. Not by much, maybe 5-6 years, but for some reason it felt different to me, because the 60s, when this series is taking place, was different from the 50s in my mind. So that's one thing. The other thing is that I really had a problem getting beyond, at least initially, the fact that Johnny Flynn is in his 40s. Andrew Scott is in his 40s. And that
Andrew
changes.
Andrew Scott actually is 47, and Ripley, the character in the book at least, is supposedly 25.
Right. And I think that's a huge difference. If your kid was off in Italy and had been lollygagging for 25 years, I think that you would have a different approach than if he had been taking an extended gap year to experiment with his music or his art or whatever it is. And so that was something that it was really difficult for me to get beyond, because I think that fresh-faced youth is part of Ripley's charm, if there is such a thing.
At least in the first story.
Correct,
yeah.
Correct. And right. So I think that Andrew Scott's portrayal is great, but it was so creepy. It didn't quite work. Why would anyone hang out with this iteration of Tom? Why would they spend even 5 minutes with him? And that was my problem, I think. And it was a choice that was made, and I know that Dan disagrees, but that's why we can have a spirited discussion about who, what, when, where, why.
It gave me pause, too, because even though I think Andrew Scott is great, if you haven't seen All of Us Strangers, I know it's streaming out there. He's amazing in that movie.
Go back and watch Sherlock from 14 years ago when Fleabag, he plays Moriarty.
Fleabag.
Yeah. High Priest.
He's good in everything. The age thing did stop me short because I agree that even though Highsmith followed Ripley throughout his life and throughout hers, in this particular iteration of the story, it does make more sense for both of them to be in their 20s and still kind of unsure of who they are, maybe even figuring out their sexualities, because that's certainly a component of a lot of Highsmith's work. The sort of erotic tension that has developed in other adaptations isn't really here in this version of Ripley. The whole thing kind of feels chilly and distant, I think deliberately so.
Yes.
I mean, you look at Elswit cinematography, which I think is the selling point of
exactly.
this series.
It's amazing.
But it's this particular kind of black and white, this digital black and white, where there are moments where the Ripley character almost appears to be operating in a void, where he's just surrounded by white space or black space. And it just kind of gives him this distant alien quality. And then every time Andrew Scott as Ripley has to, you know, clean up something that he did or bumbles his way through another thing, it kind of brings that character back down to earth. And we realize, oh, this is a human man, but he has the capacity to be seemingly inhuman. And so I thought the cinematography really brought the character more into focus. It's one of those instances where the style is the substance here, I think. At the same time, I think that the black and white also kind of, again, I think this is deliberate, sort of robs it of its period detail in a strange way. Everything feels kind of washed out. Like, you could say that this was set in the 90s with a few tweaks, and I might believe it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I think there's something kind of interesting and strange, maybe even a little bit surreal about this adaptation that I haven't seen in others.
Well, that notion of the time frame is really interesting in terms of it being set in Italy, because even today in 2024,
of course,
you can walk down certain streets in Italy and you think, am I in the Middle Ages?
Yes.
So I think that part, it makes perfect. But we have to face it, the very first sequences are shot in New York, and they managed to make New York look like 1960 New York. Mm-hmm. Also, and by the way, the time frame is only off about 5 years, because the novel came out in 1955.
Okay.
So, you know, he only and I read something. The reason why he did that was because he could only get these particular Cinquecento automobiles, a particular style, which came out in 1960. So,
well, and let's go back to Caravaggio, because there's lots of references to Caravaggio.
Lots of references and
underlined, boldened, and italicked to Caravaggio, because as we're told, Caravaggio, the painter, actually did commit a murder and then had to go on the run. And so a lot of his career was spent evading capture.
Yep.
And then there's talk about this very specific painting he made of David and Goliath, where he used his own face as the model for both David and Goliath.
Yeah.
And the show, Ripley, basically stares at that painting, and then we get a long shot of Andrew Scott's face as he looks at it, so that they're sure that we get what they're trying to say here, the duality of man, if you will. But, you know, I thought that was kind of an interesting little detail, even though it was not subtle.
As somebody who's traveled through Italy trying to find as many Caravaggios as I can,
it works.
I know, for me. Next stop, Malta.
Yeah.
But we haven't talked about Dakota Fanning because I was surprised by her performance.
Maybe, and remember, this was a child actress.
Right. And
she's grown up.
And I think that I liked the way that she played being Dickie's girlfriend, and she knew that something was, you know, maybe happening in their relationship that she couldn't identify. And I think that the way she played that was really important, because when he goes missing in a relationship that had been mostly intact, it would have prompted different responses from her. And the fact that she was willing to believe that Dickie was writing to her when it's really Tom, I mean, that was a sort of tough path to navigate in terms of making us believe that she was that naive. But then you start to realize, oh, I mean, she was involved in her work. She knew Dickie was not a good painter. She knew that maybe he was pulling away. This all made sense to her somehow. Because if you don't believe that performance, then I think the story falls apart to some extent.
And I don't think every single thing about the Ripley series works. Some of the association he has with the Italian investigator, there's a sequence there that I'm not going to give it away, but it's, to me, it was like, oh, really? Come on, that's not going to happen. But the look of this is so amazing that I forgive it virtually everything.
Well, and I still don't know if this needed to be an 8-episode series. I think it could have been trimmed a little bit. I still prefer the nice, tight, you know, 130-minute right. version of this story that we got, even if it didn't follow the book totally. I think there's some
Mandela, there's some
breathing room in this
Well, you get to hear people you know, speak Italian and American and British accents.
Yes,
so what could be bad about that?
Yeah. Anyway, that was our discussion of the Netflix series Ripley. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to delve further into the cinematic realm of all things Patricia Highsmith. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthar, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the new Netflix series Ripley, based on the Patricia Highsmith novel The Talented Mr. Ripley. Let's now turn to other Highsmith adaptations and both choose our favorites and do our best to explain why we like them. As I said in the first half of the show, Highsmith wrote 22 novels and a number of short stories. In addition to what Stephen Zalian created for his 8-episode Netflix series, Ripley, and numerous television shows, Highsmith's favorite character has been interpreted by various actors such as Alain Delon in 1960's Purple Moon, by Dennis Hopper, no less, in 1977's The American Friend, by Matt Damon in 1999's The Talented Mr. Ripley, by John Malkovich in 2002's Ripley's Game, and by Barry Pepper in 2005's Ripley Underground. Each performance is unique, owing to Highsmith's refusal to pin down Ripley's motives other than a psychopathic need to get what he wants. For the most part, Highsmith's work features a range of such characters, and we're now going to share with you each of our personal favorites. Mary Pat, why don't you start us off?
Maybe it's appropriate that I begin, because the film that I chose is The Talented Mr. Ripley from 1999. And it was written and directed by Anthony Minghella, with whom I have a love-hate relationship. And it starred Matt Damon as Ripley and Jude Law as Dickie and Gwyneth Paltrow as Marge. And it's definitely the tone of this film is completely different to my way of observation, because it really is a group of 20-somethings who are like hanging out and sort of living the good life, la dolce vita, on the beach. And it's much brighter and it's much more fun-filled, at least at first. And I think the problem with the Ripley portrayal is that the backstory of Ripley is always a little unclear in all of these portrayals, and purposely so. But I think the Matt Damon portrayal of Tom Ripley, I mean, he was a piano player. He had talent. He was all about music, whereas the Ripley series portrayal, it's more art-focused. And that makes some sense because we know what happens maybe later. But I just thought that they changed some of the facts here in The Talented Mr. Ripley. Some characters were added. So the Cate Blanchett character that shows up was not in the book, and she's not in this particular film. I think that we get a bigger or a better sense that Dickie was really sent away by his dad in The Talented Mr. Ripley, because maybe he had done something a little untoward, not thinking Brett Kavanaugh, just saying. But I think so his dad sent him away, but expected him to come back at some point. And I think that he was much more of a freewheeling womanizer in The Talented Mr. Ripley than turned out to be the case. And he did have this sort of violent past. The other thing is, there was more sexual tension
yep.
in The Talented Mr. Ripley, and I think that made it work better.
There was not some more. There yeah. wasn't more. There was some
because there's
sexual
really
tension
none in the Ripley miniseries. Yeah, I agree with you. I love this sort of sunny, simmering quality of this movie.
And Philip Seymour Hoffman?
Yes, amazing, amazing as Freddie Miles. Yeah, I just think that you could photograph this cast in any way, and at this point in time, they're all so beautiful, and the locations are beautiful.
Yeah.
And then there's this evil decay underneath. Yeah, I like this movie a lot.
Well, never mind. Go on. Let's go on and pick yours.
Well, I want to take a little break from Ripley and talk
about will also,
our favorite Highsmith adaptations. And the one that I picked was Carol.
Carol, which is a movie that all three of us like.
Yeah, directed by Todd Haynes. And it was based on a 1952 novel by Highsmith called The Price of Salt, which was her second book. It was released after Strangers on a Train, which was her debut, but it was originally published under a pseudonym, Claire Morgan, mainly because it dealt with lesbian themes. Mm-hmm. Highsmith was herself gay, and her publishers thought, I don't know if this is a great idea for your reputation in the 1950s. And it was semi-autobiographical.
Mm-hmm.
And so they published it under this nom de plume, but it was republished in the 90s under Highsmith's name and under the title Carol. So they eventually retitled it. And it's also, like Strangers on a Train, about two strangers who encounter each other and become fascinated by one another. But this is the rare Highsmith story that is not a thriller. It's a romance, even though there is intrigue going on. And it's about this young woman working in a department store who has an interaction with an older married socialite. In the film, Carol, she's played by Cate Blanchett, and the young woman is played by Rooney Mara.
Isn't it funny? Cate Blanchett keeps showing up here,
right.
Doesn't she?
Yeah, look at that. She just loves Patricia Highsmith. And then the movie is just about them falling in love, knowing that maybe they shouldn't, but being drawn to each other. There's a magnetism there. And we talked about period detail in all of these movies because, you know, they're all set in the time that the novels were actually written. I love the period detail in this movie, just the warmth of the settings. The costumes are all amazing. And then you have the two central performances by Blanchett and Mara that I think are riveting and deep. They really create two human characters. And even when the movie goes into a somewhat predictable direction involving Carol's husband trying to catch her, you know, in the middle of a dalliance so that he can get the kids in their sort of acrimonious split, it still works somehow. And I just think, I mean, you know my love of Todd Haynes. I think this may be his best movie.
You know,
it's certainly one of his greats.
I agree with you there because as you love Todd Haynes, I'm up and down about the guy. But I really liked Carol very much. I just think that it's a wonderful portrayal. It's really well made. The colors are beautiful. It feels right to the time. And I love the performances.
And I agree that it is the sort of set pieces that I remember most mm-hmm. about this film, along with the performances. And I think the fact that it was semi-autobiographical is an important feature of this because how much could you tell? How much could you reveal? And we know back in the 1950s, not much.
Yes. And it's also notable because it has a less than tragic ending, which was unusual for queer romances at the time and still kind of plagues that genre. But yeah, Carol, I mean, if you haven't seen it, see Carol.
You definitely should see it. Well, I'm going to go back to the classics and I'm going to go back to Alfred Hitchcock's version of Strangers on a Train.
I think I've heard of this one.
I think so also. Yeah. It was released in 1951, just a year after the novel itself was published. And, you know, it's Hitchcock. We all know Hitchcock. We all know his quirks. And this movie is filled with them. But I think that the main thing I really like about Strangers on a Train, and you can go back and you should watch it again, but if you don't want to go back and watch it again, you can see bits and pieces of it on YouTube. There are a lot of the most famous scenes. And just two, I think, are amazing. And they show not only his ability, his genius at creating a scene, but also his willingness to take risks. And one is, and they worked really hard on this, is the murder of Guy Haynes' wife, which takes place on an island. And it's shot mostly through the reflection of the soon-to-be-dead woman's eyeglasses, which fall off. And then you see that. and it was really hard to shoot it, apparently. The second scene is amazing, and I watched it again the other night, and it's edited so well. It's the climactic scene of the movie, and it takes place on a carousel, which goes faster and faster and faster. And, you know, Bruno, played by Robert Walker, and Guy Haines, played by Farley Granger, are fighting. And yet it's like Hitchcock also, that even in the midst of intensity, there's a moment in which a woman goes, "My boy, my boy!" And the two men fighting each other come up against this, this horse. And this kid is just riding a horse like with a big grin on his face. And he starts hitting Robert Walker, and Walker knocks him off. And then Guy has to save the kid. And all the whole time, the worker is crawling underneath it. And it cuts back and forth. It's just an amazing scene. And it's in magical black and white also. So I just absolutely love
Strangers on a Train. And think of how Hitchcock came upon that material in such close proximity to when it was written by this unknown artist. And the fact that he was able to see the potential in the way that this story could be filmed and was filmed.
Although apparently shorted Patricia Highsmith on the money that she deserved for that. Yeah. I also want to call out, if we're talking about Strangers on a Train, which I also love, one of my favorite Hitchcocks, is Danny DeVito's 1987 movie, Throw Mama from the Train, which is heavily inspired by Strangers on a Train, features lots of scenes from Strangers on a Train. I think that's kind of a little forgotten, underappreciated comedy.
I, too, liked that
with
film.
Ann Ramsey, Oscar-nominated Ann Ramsey. That would be a great double feature. Strangers on a Train, Throw Mama from the Train.
Yeah.
Both, I think, indebted to Patricia Highsmith.
I think Ann Ramsey could have played in La Chimera. She could have been.
I would love it if she had been in more movies. Mama Fratelli.
All right, let's go back to Ripley. What is it about these sociopaths that draws? Anybody have a...
Well, you know my affection for murder shows generally, so I guess maybe I would have to weigh in on that. And I do think that, you know, for women, one of the reasons that women sometimes gravitate toward these true crime shows is, you know, they want to control, they want to protect themselves, be safe, and so forth. And I don't know if I've encountered any Tom Ripleys in my life.
That you know of.
But I'm going to be able to identify them, I think.
At any rate, that was our discussion of the various movies adapted from the novels of Patricia Highsmith. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbender, and Murray Petruthart, and I discuss the new Netflix series Ripley, based on Highsmith's novel The Talented Mr. Ripley. Let's take this moment to thank Cassie Fox for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, wherever we can find it. Until then, consider these words from Highsmith herself, voiced from her favorite character in the novel Ripley Underground. "Honestly, I don't understand why people get so worked up about a little murder." You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.